Kenya. And before that, a number of years ago, because I get fascinated, and I love people. Well, not so much the ones today, but I have loved many people who busk in the mall. And there was this young fellow, his name was Garner Cronin. And I went up to him, I said, "Mate," because he wasn't an Aboriginal fella. I said, "Where'd you get that name Garner from?" He said, "Oh, my parents, we live at Glenelg, and they love the culture of the Aboriginal people, so they call me Garner." And I said, "Fantastic." So oddly enough, I think I've even got his album, because I found it the other day when I was telling this. Yeah, I do. Look, see? Garner Cronin.
Wow.
But yeah, I think people miss the point behind it, and people get into fear that they're going to lose. It's like, remember when Rudd said sorry? They were going, "Oh, don't say sorry, mate, because we'll have compensation." How many people got compensation? How many people lost their land? No one. Because we build fear. Politicians, media build fear into people, and it's not there. It's actually an urban myth. And our people, because you've just got to look at our people, who's been killed for their land, who's lost their land, who's the ones that are still putting their hand out because we're suffering, we're still living in third world conditions in a first world country. Who's got the poor health, the poor education, the poor accommodation? It's still the Aboriginal people. And yet we keep ignoring, saying, "Oh no, we've given them enough. That's enough now. We can't give them any more." Well, what have you really given them? You've made them dependent on Western world needs, but you haven't taught them how Western world works, and nor should a Western world be what you should be teaching them, because it's not gonna. If they're living in remote community, there's no jobs out there.
No.
To be doing teaching or anything like that in the sense of a modern world, because they live in a remote world, and so therefore, let's teach them the things that's going to allow them to live in a remote world. Like you would have seen probably on TV, how sad was that to find out that the APY overheads, they have recycling sort of things, and then they just burn the whole lot. Oh, because we can't process it because of their remoteness, and
it's probably bad for the environment.
But it's the
it's what we do.
It's the only thing we can do because we need to reduce the amount of it, and so we just burn the lot. Are you kidding me? There's surely, there's clever people around the world. There's ways of, like using those materials maybe to build houses, because they don't have houses out there. Because we've seen people build houses out of hay. We've seen people build.
Yeah.
I've seen houses built out of bottles.
Yeah.
And
tires.
Tires. Yeah. And so you think, let's,
It can be done.
And actually, I was been watching a show just recently called "You Can't Make a House Out of That," and the blokes made it out of. I've seen them. They've made them out of 20-foot containers or a shed, or they've made it out of old milk vans and all this sort of stuff, and turn them into houses. Obviously they've modified them, but they've used largely some of these materials that are around. And I think we need clever people to be thinking of those ways of being sustainable and reusing, repurposing. Now we are so clever. One time when we repurposed, sometimes it looked like it was repurposed because it was slapped together. Whereas now there's people are so clever, they can make something that looked old or was old or was had another purpose, but they can make it look modern and purposeful and stuff. Because there's, as some people would say, there's not only physical pollution, there's also visual pollution too.
Yeah.
And so we can be creative. And that's where listening to the land, and that's why our people were good. They understood the movement across lands and across seasons. And I think, talk unteaching, I don't think it's so much unteaching. I think it's really just teaching cultural lessons alongside the Western world lessons. I think if we do that, then we're going to get the best of both worlds. Because you can't completely take away the Western world.
No.
You can't.
No.
There's too many of them.
It's here.
And it's like I said, without being rude to you, like, you've got your community here, but really, the rest of the people around you are living in the other world, aren't they?
Exactly.
And as we've seen, a perfect solution, which I find so amazing, like the Amish people.
Yeah.
You know, here they are. They're still living those old ways, building everything without electricity and modern tools and all that sort of stuff. And what's even amazing, I saw a little documentary on them once, and they allow the kids when they get to their late teens to go and into the modern world. They say, right, yeah, go drink, go drive a car, go to the school, do all that sort of stuff, right? And you'd think, like, these people who have basically living by candles, getting up early and going to bed early and having to, you know, make their food and make their clothing and work off the land, you'd think, oh, wait, they're going to join the modern world once they've got a taste of it. Something like 70 to 80% of them will go back.
They came back.
And you just think, that's amazing.
Mm.
Amazing. That's a high number.
Mm.
So we get fearful that we need to constantly have change. And change should happen, but change should be because it's a better way, or it's a needed way because something else is driving it, not because I have an opinion or I want to sell something to create change. It should be for needs, not wants. That's the thing that our people lived off. It was needs. You did things because you had a need, not a want. And it's when we get to wants, I think that's our problem. I know we laugh, you know, those shows like The Brady Bunch, even Happy Days, and these shows, they're, and even MASH, old-time classics, are still shown today.
Yeah.
We laugh at them sometimes at the, not the content so much, but the acting and maybe the scenery. But they all had positive, they taught kids how to, when you had got bullied or you looked different or you went through your changes or when you looked at, and there was very little violence or anything like that in it, right? But now what are we doing? Which we all love to some degree. We're watching reality shows now. How to cook, how to build, how to have a relationship, right? But what are the things that we need in those shows to make you watch them? It's not, oh, you built something nice there. Oh, no, you had a fight with the guy next to you to get to build that. Or, oh, that cooking thing, oh, you made a disaster in somebody else. Or that relationship, oh, yeah, that person said you were ugly. So we want to see all the human drama, the physical, all the negative stuff to what make us watch what is reality, but we're not actually getting the life lessons of well, we shouldn't fight with each other, or we should work in harmony, or
and you know, look forward to it,
and we should learn the skills of how to make that and not be judged because you didn't do it perfectly. It's like language. When I was trying to learn Kaurna language, I got put off because the linguist would go, you know, for argument's sake, just he'd say, Ninamani, and I go, Ninamani, no, it's like Ninamani, no, it's, and he's saying, you're saying it wrong, you've got to, you know, put your tongue here, or roll your tongue there, and whatever. And I go, mate, whatever you're saying, whatever I'm hearing, is what I'm saying and hearing back.
Yeah.
And I just can't understand, and he said, and I'm saying, language, you know, and this is a bit rude, but you say, language is about communication. So if I've obviously communicated because you know I've said it wrong.
Yeah.
So therefore, is it wrong? Now, it is wrong because, you know, we shouldn't bastardize language. You know, we should get it right wherever possible. But we know in society there's people that have, you know, difficulty saying languages because they might have lisps.
Yeah.
Or they might have stutters and and all those sorts of things.
There's all sorts of ways.
And even interpretation, like, you know, you'll hear a lot of Aboriginal people particularly, they'll put an R in the word ask. They go ask. They don't go ask.
Yeah.
They go ask, you know. But we don't go, oh, mate, that's not how you say ask. It's, you know, you put an R in there. Well, no, we know what they're saying.
Yeah.
We accept that.
Yeah.
Is it garage or is it garage? Doesn't matter. You know what they're talking about. And so sometimes I think we go too far with languages. But at the same token, yes, we got to get it right. But, you know, like I said, I got a fear, and so I stopped wanting to learn the Kaurna language because I felt like, oh, I'm not going to get it right. My brain can't concept the learnings behind it and all that. So now I've got to get the fear out and I've got to go back and actually learn it because, you know, I can do it scripted, but I can't do it conversing. And I feel I need to now do it conversing for future generations particularly and the continuation and I suppose that.
Because the Kaurna language was lost for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was lost because, like nearly all the languages, it was against the law to speak the language back in 1865. But where we were lucky was, and sadly not all language groups were like that, but sadly we had the German missionaries record 3,000 words. So that's given us the basis to rebuild our language. What we found, though, is because, like they did, they recorded it in a sense their interpretation of the language. And it wasn't through, definitely through people like Dad and Nanny Alice and obviously Rob Amory at the university, the linguist, but they started to realise that they did make mistakes in some of the language. Like, you know, now we find that we've only got three of the vowels, not the five vowels. Like, we don't use I's and E's. We don't use O's and E's. We use A's, U's and I's. And a lot of that came about when they started conversing in the language. They started picking up, you know how, to some degrees, there's formulas when you speak. I mean, English sometimes ruins those formulas. But largely, particularly when Jack Buckskin started learning the language and he started teaching it to his kids. So then he started having a conversation with the kids and then the kids would pick up the faults.
Wow.
Yeah, they would actually pick up the faults and go, no, Dad, because you taught us to say it this way, but now you're telling us we've got to say it completely a different way with these words, which means that there's no formula, there's no continuation, and that's how we just...
It's a kid's brain to do that.
And that's a kid. So that when you talk about unlearning, here's the kid that's actually teaching us the correctness of the language because he's not influenced by any other system of I suppose, language.
Now, there's a crystal. That's really important.
It is. I mean, actually, one of the stories, which is a world-known story, really, cultural story, it's not an Aboriginal story, it's a world-known story, which is the starfish story. And again, it's really about youth teaching us as old people. You know, here it is, there's this young fellow walking along the beach and he's noticed by this elder, he's picking up something off the beach and chucking it into the ocean. And so the elder, who's inquisitive, comes down off the sand dunes and walks behind this youth and he sees that he's picking up these starfish off the beach and just chucking them in the ocean. So he walks up and he says, "What do you hope to achieve? There's literally thousands of starfish on this beach. You wouldn't be able to pick up all of them and throw them into the ocean." And the young fellow picks up another one and he said, "It makes a difference to that one." And the point is that we can all make differences, sure. Maybe not to everybody, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't stop trying to make a difference to everybody. And so we can pick up one starfish or we can pick up a lot of starfish. But the point is picking up the starfish is the point.
Still making the difference.
Yeah, still making the difference. And so, you know, and I think it's an important story. Mm. But it's young people that have taught us that story. You know, and so storytelling, you know, and that's why the greatness of our... Because we were an oral society, we had to work off of stories. Because we couldn't write these things down. So it had to be stories. And so, because you can remember stories, you can't remember specific things, but you can remember stories or songs and things like that, or when you physically walk the land and those sorts of elements, or get taught something physically. And so, therefore, it's important because then when we do these things, we can actually understand those balances and harmonies of things. Like, it's like what we would say, Gupa stories or the Bunyip scary stories, right? Well, they weren't stories necessary to scare you. It was to teach you the understanding, the importance of protection. I tell this story, which was told to me, which Dad has told to lots of people over many years, called Mr. Wind. And basically, the story is how he went on a journey with great uncle to learn some cultural values. Well, as they walked the land, night started to fall behind them, so they had to set up camp. So they clicked the wood, built a fire. Great uncles went to sleep. Dad there, young, excited, could hear the noises of the animals around him, the stars he could see in the sky. And all of a sudden he could hear the wind, and the wind started rustling, and it went across the bushes and got louder and louder. And he felt that the wind was talking to him, so he got up out of his bed and he started walking to the wind. He started running into the wind and felt the wind was saying his name, come closer, come closer. And then all of a sudden, as you're saying, come closer, then all of a sudden you yell out, and then it grabbed him, like that, right? And the idea is you then say, and it's his great uncle, and his great uncle says, well, boy, don't you know the darkness will get in your eyes, never leave my sight. And so therefore, what that tells us as young people, we've got to stay beside our elders and our leaders and that, because they protect us, keep us safe. They teach us, but they keep us safe. But it also tells our parents and our teachers and our leaders in the community that we still got to keep an eye on our young people. We can't let them wander too far, because if we do let them, they'll get lost or they'll do the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, it's a double story. And as Dad always talks about, you know, we always had this, when we told things, it was about two-ness, two-way thinking. And, you know, sometimes they even said, you know, there wasn't right and wrong. It was just different. You know, but we live in society today, it's got to be right or it's wrong, isn't it?
That's pretty profound too.
Yeah.
Two ways thinking.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's what our people did, you know, and that's what their basis of life, like it says, I can't eat everything because I've got to leave something for somebody else.
Yeah.
Or I've got to share, or I've got to, you know, in a sense, accept that it's not about them being wrong, me about being right. It's about there's differences in life. And you know, here we are. You know, it's not about the child being the person has to listen to the adult. It's the adult also has to listen to the child. And so it's this like I said, this completeness and, as they used to say, this reciprocity, which is, you know, mutual benefit. Mm-hmm. We've lost that ability to see that in life, I think.
And we're encouraged to just think of ourselves and
our family. We are.
It suits the government because it keeps us compliant.
Well, it does, and we are. We're becoming these, we don't realise we are cookie cutters, cutted people, and, you know, we are, in a sense, sheep when we follow, and we don't make decisions, really. I remember seeing this guy, I did an opening for this guy, he was from South Australia, but he lives in America now, and he's had a multitude of skills, but I think, I can't remember what his skill was now, it was nearly on the tip of my tongue there, but anyway, what was interesting about him was, he talked about his journey in some ways, how he Red Gum's story gave him a journey of himself, which he repeated because he worked at National Geographic store and they knew they could get a grant from the National Geographic to do some exploring if they could do something that was in their thing. And so he went on that Red Gum song story about, what was that, where we, Australia, oddly enough, try to set up another community in another nation. Was it New Paraguay or... it's in Red Gum store.
In West Australia?
No, it was in another country. Anyway.
Yeah.
So he told that story. And the funny thing was he did it on the same, like 25 years later or something, he did it, the same journey, and it happened to be on those same equal days that it went. Anyway. He then came back and he it sort of helped him then think about life and how we view and see life. And what he did was, interestingly, he got iPads and he got those, you know, those sit-down massage chairs where you put your face in there and you sit down? So he strapped these iPads to these chairs, right? And he's put this signage up. Oh, for those people that live in urban cities that are busy and can't get out into the environment and touch and feel and see and smell and hear the noises of the beautiful countryside, we can give that to you in 10 minutes by just sitting down and watching this iPad view of the sounds and the views of this world. And we're coming out next season with a winter collection and all this sort of stuff, right? And people go, yes, I want it. And what he was trying to do, he wasn't trying to sell this product. What he came out was the following year, he went one step further, and he actually got, because I think he had a bit of a background in graphic design, and he made a futuristic baby capsule or pod, and he got a futuristic looking, real looking baby, put it in this pod, right? So his first thing was called Nature Pod. The second thing he called was Nurture Pod, and basically it was this baby in there, and it's got all that VR stuff, you know, the VR goggles, the movement wristbands and the movement armbands, and it's sitting in there, and he's put a price tag on it as well, right?
Wow.
And he said, you know, this is for the modern busy mum where, you know, she, you know, needs to be able to entertain and monitor their child in a way that doesn't have physical, you know, needs all the time. And people go, yes, I want it. I want to buy it. I want to buy it. And he wasn't selling this stuff. What he wanted to do was open up the conversation to people and say, you can't just accept what people give you. You've got to start asking the question, do I need it? Do they need to be producing it? So therefore, I've got to be in the conversation of why people were creating these things, because, like I said earlier, we're sheep. We all of a sudden accept it, and now it's a part of our lives. But that's because we didn't enter into the conversation in the first place, and said no, we shouldn't be accepting it, or we should be going, okay, if we're going to accept it, let's understand, should it be there in the first place? Is it a need or is it just a want? And that's what he was trying to generate. He wanted the people to have the conversation, not just be the acceptance of. Of what life.
Well, that's so clever.
It was so clever.
Nature versus nurture.
Yeah. And what he did was he also talked about how now some places have actually taken some of his concepts to help drive the conversation they need to have. Like he said, he worked for a council. He did one. He was given an opportunity to facilitate a council's need to see how society. Or how the council area should look for the future. And so one of the things he did was he set up all these different environments, and he got people that were doing the surveys to even dress up like those environments. Like there was some in military gear, some in what you would say holiday type, Hawaii type gear, and then some people in suits and ties, and so because what he was trying to do was get people to be thinking, but not just be completely influenced by also the imagery and be forced, because when you look at it, are you going to talk or be forced into thinking in a military style or in a casual style or in a formal style? And so it was very clever because it got us thinking, because we can think, but we stop thinking.
And thinking along those lines is, I mean, it's scary.
It is.
How people manipulate
you. Yeah, it is.
And you go, oh.
But then we'll get to the same. We complain because all of a sudden it does impact us.
Yeah.
But that's the only time when we do. Whereas we didn't enter in the conversation in the first place, and we should all enter in the conversation.
Just say I want it.
Yeah, and that's exactly. And so he wasn't trying to stop development or try to or not say that people shouldn't create things. What he was trying to say is we should all actually play a part in anything that is being. It's a part of our lives and society, so that we, because we've had the conversation, all of a sudden, for instance, as there's been talk, you know, we don't lose our open space. Because, you know, our people, for instance, the Aboriginal people understood open space. It was about fire protection, wind protection. It was about, you know, making sure it complemented the environment when we talk about, you know, rain and sun and also even body feeling, like, because when you touch and see nature, it makes you feel nice, doesn't it?
It makes you feel good.
You see concrete.
Yeah.
Doesn't make you feel nice, does it?
Not at all. And sometimes you just yearn for it.
You do. And this is the thing. And so our people, you know, influenced Colonel Light when he designed Adelaide. You know, and that's why, you know, we have these green belts and green parts of the city. But what are we doing now? We want to fill them up with...
It's one of the beautiful things.
Yeah, I know.
That surrounded by parklands,
yeah,
and regionally based, and and beautiful.
Yeah. But we want to cover them up, you know. We want to use it. We want to put buildings on and things like that. And you know, we've got to stop thinking about it. It's not, and like I said earlier, you know, it's not about getting everybody to live in the city.
No.
In some ways, oddly enough, Canberra sort of set up in many cities. You know, yeah, they wanted people to live in the many, to live in many cities.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, they don't really live like many cities, which I find fascinating. It was about saying, "Well, you just stay in these little cities," because my brother-in-law was, you know, because they live in Canberra. Well, he's passed away now, but. And he would tell me, you know, how Canberra and why it's like this and all this. And then I look in his front yard and every one of his children's got a car.
Mm.
And I'm thinking,
yeah.
What's going on here? You're not using the public transport that they've set up or the bike trails that they've set up or the fact that you're supposed to live locally and work locally. And so I used to laugh and giggle that, you know, at the end of the day, you're going against the concept. So, you know, and therefore you're actually putting pollution in and all that green space between the city and the suburbs is now being wasted.
Yeah.
Because you're driving past it, looking at it, but that's about all you're doing.
Yeah, and it's just as congested as anywhere else.
It is, it is. So, yeah, so, but, yeah, like I said, I think really when we talk, and I do agree with the unlearning, I think the unlearning is that we need to complement with the cultural thinking that the way that our people understood the land and we should take those concepts and those values and so, you know, look, I believe in life, everything to some degree is transferable.
Be a part of the Centre for Unlearning?
If I can contribute, I'm not. You know, I know it's been wonderful to talk with you and, you know, share my own views and opinions and all that, but I don't believe I am really a great thinker, not like Dad. Dad's such a wise person because he one, is a great reader. He's also a person who's got a great sense of retaining information and knowledge, but also, too, he's very worldly in so many things, you know, when you look, not just culture, he also knows technology, machinery, he knows construction and designs and understandings of modern worlds and what's influenced and changed. And so he's such a worldly man, and that's why I've been trying to get some people to certainly record specifically his cultural knowledge, because he's old school, you know, it's oral, so it means when it's oral, it's in your head. It's not on paper.
Could I do some of that?
Yeah. I've got a few people that have been, you know, trying to help me drum up, because the thing is, see, what we've lost in society today is we don't sit with our old people anymore.
Mm.
We don't spend that time to learn this knowledge, because knowledge isn't learned in 5 minutes. It's learned over, you know, exploring and spending time and actually following through with that information. And so today we, you know, when I look, particularly when I look at culture, you know, I've got to put bread and butter on the table, so it means I've got to go to work. And so the time when you catch up with, you know, that knowledge, and, you know, when a young kid you could get that knowledge, but then sometimes you were too interested in just running around and having no responsibilities. But now when you find you've got responsibilities to your family and children, and to get the knowledge and information off Dad, it makes it hard, because you can only spend the 5 minutes with him to get that. And then Dad, being old school too, I remember he was like, "I'm going to tell you once, and I'm telling you once only." And so you always get fearful, because you think, oh, if I ask him again, he's not going to tell me, and then he's going to get wild and upset with me. But, you know, that's the concentration of learning and teachings. And that's why sometimes, you know, I think, you know, maybe I'm not the person. Sometimes people think, oh, you're the next Lewis O'Brien. Well, I think, no, I'm not the next Lewis O'Brien. I might have parts of Lewis O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say, you know, I've got to record this, because, you know, I'll forget this information that he's collected and learnt and listened to from all the old people. And so it's important to get that, because if we lose it again, we may never get it back again.
That's right. Can't happen.
You know, because, you know, people like Dad and some of those before worked hard to get that stuff back. And you know, and so it's important to, you know, make sure we never lose it again. So I get worried about that because, as we've seen just in recent years, only Joe, Sonny, Alice, even young fella Stevie, and only Veronica, all these people who had great knowledge, great strength, they've are gone.
Mm.
And Dad's 88.
Mum's, is he 88?
Yeah, he's 88. Mum's 83.
Wow.
And I'll love him to live forever, but we live to die, sadly. And so his day will come. I hope it's not tomorrow or in any near future. But, yeah, I'd like to be long enough to make sure that we've got his knowledge and wisdom recorded.
Well, actually, would be happy at any time, and I'd go there.
Yeah.
If... Yeah. You know, if they were happy to have me, because I just think it's so important to get...
Yeah, well, I've been telling Dad to do that, and he's open to it these days, which is good, because I keep telling him he's got to, because, you know, it's not, as I keep telling him, it's not about you, Dad. It's about the culture and the continuation of it all. He understands that. And so, yeah, the only problem is, see... I know one time, you know, because Dad still gets asked lots of different questions, but the thing that he's not good at doing anymore is, you know, he used to write a lot. And now, because I remember once Dad and I, Dad got invited to this conference workshop thing on cultural learnings and understandings when it comes to environmental architecture and building architecture. And Dave gave, a really nice speech and everything. And then he was asked to, can you write all this stuff? And Dad said, no, I can't, because he just doesn't have that. Because when you write something, as you would know, when you write something, it's harder than actually saying it.
Oh, it really is, yeah.
Because you can't, when you talk, you can add in so many other elements. Whereas when you write something, you can't write, you know, the transcript...
Mm.
To some degree doesn't make sense when it's word for word.
Yeah.
So when you write, you're actually got to be creative. And so, you know, Dad doesn't have that ability to sit there and think it about, you know, not putting in ums or ahs or like you do when you speak or have pauses. You know, you're constantly writing. And so, you know, so he doesn't write down much these days. He's happy to talk about it. But writing now
that's
is...
That's where these things are so good, because it's always...
But the thing is, that's good, but somebody still has to...
Transcribe.
I mean, you can listen, but if you're trying to find something specifically or to hear something specifically, it needs some reference points put into it.
But the good thing about doing it this way, I mean, you do have to get someone to transcribe, but is that you can actually listen back.
Oh,
and then remember things that you've forgotten to say.
Oh, of course.
Which with reading, by the time you've read the next page, you've forgotten the one before.
Hey, do you know the guy? He got me to come in and talk to him the other day, actually. Square Holes?
Who?
Square Holes.
Square Hole, yeah.
The Square Holes people?
Yeah.
He got me to come in there the other day and talk to him. A bit about just myself, and anyway, he sent me yesterday a recording of it.
Okay.
Oh my gosh! I'm going and the, and it was like, oh my gosh, this is a terrible. And then also too, at the time when he got me, I had a little bit of a, I suppose, well, I didn't really have a cold or anything. I was ill, and so I got to take a lot of antibiotics, and the antibiotics muck around with my digestive system.
Oh, they muck around with everything, don't they?
Yeah. And so when he had me there, I was trying to hold back lots of different digestive movements, like, you know, burps and things like this. And and so when I was listening to it, you can hear me go, you know, trying to touch, I'm sort of licking my lips, or, you know, it's like really it was me trying.